As many of you know, before I went into the ministry, I had another career. I was a fundraiser in higher education. And there was a lot I really enjoyed about the work and a lot that was really fulfilling. I got to make sure that there were monies available to fund good causes and to help worthy students get a great education. I was able to make sure that research projects were funded and all sorts of good things could happen. I got to meet lots of really smart, interesting people all across the country, and indeed around the world. But like any job, there were pitfalls. There were elements of it that I could do without. And one of them came to mind as I was reading about this dinner party at the home of Lazarus and Martha and Mary. I remembered our annual black tie donor dinner in New York City. Now, this was a very spiffy event. People had to give a lot of money to be invited to this dinner. But we were fortunate that a lot of people wanted to help us out. So we would have generally 150 alumni coming to this very lovely dinner. In addition to the graduates of the school, we would have the dean and some faculty members. And then there were my colleagues who wanted to come too because they hoped that they would have a chance to talk to some of their prospects. Wonderful evening, lots of fun, except I was one of the people responsible for the seating arrangements. I hear a lot of knowing laughs here. Perhaps you have organized a dinner party, a wedding celebration, a graduation feast, and you've tried to figure out who gets to sit next to whom, who should be kept apart. Now, of course, before you even get to those questions, you've looked at your list of friends and family and connections, and you've decided who you should invite and who maybe should be asked to come over another time. But remember what I just said about this event in New York City. It was a donor dinner. As long as you made a gift of a sufficient size, you got to come to the dinner. I couldn't say to someone, well, nobody likes you. And we had people like that. So you can't come to the dinner. Or, I know that you and you are at loggerheads over some professional situation. And so maybe it would be better if you weren't in the same room. I couldn't do that. They all came. So I had to figure out where they would sit. I had to even deal with happy situations that could create trouble. Tables are only so large. But what happens when there are more people than there are seats who should be gathered together? Then you get to decide who has to sit somewhere else. Sometimes there weren't enough people from a group of alumni to sit at one table. So I had to figure out who would go with them. The people who came to these events were not only generous, they were also highly successful. They were used to being seen as VIPs, and so they expected to be treated as such here. But as well as they had done in life, as thoughtful as they were in supporting our organization, every single one of them was human. Every single one of them had foibles. Every single one of them had their personality quirks. And we had no choice but to deal with that and to find a way to make it work. This is the situation that's unfolding in the house of Martha and Mary and Lazarus. You start off with the family dynamics here. You remember these two sisters, right? You know, Martha is the one who goes off to the kitchen to prepare the meal and make sure everything is just right. She's the stickler for detail. And she grumbles that others aren't coming in to help her out. But she still makes sure that everybody has a good time. Then there's Mary, who wants to sit at the feet of Jesus. Not because she's a shirker, but she is spiritually grounded and she wants to learn. So we've got this sibling rivalry going on between these two sisters. And John tells us about their brother, Lazarus, who has had an unusual experience.
dead.
He was brought back to life by Jesus. Now, in the first century, there were no therapists. But I suspect Lazarus had a lot to process, and he would have benefited some for professional assistance in figuring out, what do you do when you've been dead and you come back to life? We don't know for a fact what the great beyond is like, do we? But traditionally, people have thought that if there's an afterlife and when we go to God, we're in a place of perfect joy and bliss and holiness. So imagine Lazarus having been there and then having been torn back and returned to this earth, to this place of illness and limitations and frustrations. He probably was confused and perhaps a bit resentful. We know that one of the problems that he would have had to grapple with along with his sister was what we now call financial insecurity. You heard that this dinner was taking place in Bethany. That's the anglicized version of Beit Ani, the Hebrew for house of the poor. This was an economically challenged community. These people had to figure out how to make a dollar stretch. And yet that imperative was confronted with another, and that was to offer hospitality, something that was at the core of the culture. And who shows up but Jesus and the disciples for dinner? And we know at least one of his disciples decides to make his presence known that evening, and that is Judas. Jesus' money man, his finance director, his treasurer. Now, I think we could, for the sake of this discussion, set aside John's attribution of motives to Judas. John's writing 60 or 70 years after the fact. We don't know if he's already turned to the dark side at this point. John's saying after the fact, having heard the whole story, that Judas didn't care about the poor. We don't know that. It may well have been that Judas had not yet strayed from the path of Jesus, but he had a different opinion about how to do things. And so he thought that the oil that Mary used to anoint Jesus would have been better put to other purposes. Now, we've all met people like Judas. And they've come to our parties. They have opinions about how things should be done, how the world should work, and they do not hesitate to share them. And often they're really good about saying what other people should do as opposed to themselves. And of course we have at this gathering Jesus teaching, preaching, healing, doing his ministry. But let's be honest. There's no evidence in the Gospels that Jesus is the person you invited over for small talk. Jesus doesn't do chit-chat. Jesus is driven by urgency. He has his mission. He has to get the message across. And he has to tell uncomfortable truths. So, we've got truth-telling Jesus, opinionated Judas, head in the clouds Mary, obsessive-compulsive Martha, and poor, confused Lazarus. What's going on here, and why should any of it matter to us? We know that John is not offering us some exploration of first century party etiquette. We want to get a handle on this passage and what it should mean to us. Let's think about when we're reading it. Here we are in this fifth Sunday of Lent. And yes, it fits in chronologically with the story as we're approaching Jerusalem, and we can look at foreshadowing as we hear about the anointing of Jesus, looking forward to his death. But we can also ask, what is it we're supposed to be doing during Lent? We're supposed to be reflecting on our lives, right? Asking ourselves about where we're falling short or what we could be doing differently. What's motivating us? What's driving us forward? And I think today's lesson calls us individually, as a church, as a community, as a nation, to ask ourselves questions around hospitality. How do we go about welcoming people? Who do we welcome? Do we only reach out and invite in the people who are just like us, who think just like us, who act just like us, who have our opinions, who even better will do what we tell them to do or think the way we want them to think? Or are we willing to take some risks and say, if everybody's God's child, we can reach out and extend a hand and say, come on in. We can ask ourselves questions about how we engage in hospitality. Are we doing it grudgingly, out of a sense of obligation, because the Bible tells us so? Or are we doing it out of a response to the hospitality that God has shown us in welcoming us and embracing us? Are we doing it out of love and graciousness and joy? Jesus famously says in this passage that we will always have the poor with us. One could hear that statement and think, wow, Jesus, or at least John in his telling of the story, is pretty callous, or he's fatalistic. I don't think that's the case. Jesus is alerting us to a reality that we can't just wish away. People are going to be in dire straits in this world because of bad luck, ill health, malicious actions on the part of others, a bad break, sometimes because the system or the odds are indeed rigged against them. And Jesus is saying, we need to be mindful of these folks. We need to pay attention. We need to help them. We need to be hospitable. And how are we hospitable? Well, perhaps in the way Mary was. She had something that was precious to her, and she shared it with someone she loved. Mary gave from a place of abundance and not from a mindset of scarcity. As I thought about what Mary did, I remembered some stories that my mother told me about growing up. Now, you remember, my mother's 96 years old, so she's seen a lot of living. The world has changed a lot in her lifetime. And so think about the world that the people who raised her knew and saw. My mother grew up in Newark, New Jersey in the 1920s and 30s. Very different place from the Newark of today in so many different ways. And she was raised by her aunt and uncle. And I may have mentioned this in the past, but her uncle Jack did not have a professional skill set that was particularly useful in metropolitan New York in the early decades of the 20th century. Uncle Jack was an exiled white Russian cavalryman. There wasn't much use for a horse riding, sword wielding, carabiner shooting soldier who spoke Russian. It was often the way in that day and time, and sometimes it is today too. It was the mom in the house who kept things running. Jack had his political issues, his personal issues to work through, so he was most comfortable being at home reading the papers. Aunt Penny somehow kept that house going, though. She had her own kids. She had her two nieces. And during the depths of the Depression, any number of people from the neighborhood coming in for a meal, everybody knew they could go to Fanny and Jack's and they would get dinner. And this was from a family that did not have money. But my mother always told me that her aunt served their friends and their neighbors and strangers with a smile. And she thought it was a gift and a blessing to be able to do. There was never a sense of resentment on her part. Or if there was, nobody ever saw any evidence of it. That's hospitality.
In the home in which my mother grew up, no one ever quite knew who was coming to dinner. But they were always welcome. They rolled with the punches.
Now, every first Sunday of the month, we will gather together at the table.
And we share the Lord's Supper. I'm calling it the Lord's Supper, not Eucharist, not communion in this instance, to remind us whose table we come to. It's not ours. It's not the church's. It's God's.
And when we extend the invitation to the table, each month we say that if you're willing to venture ordinary love with average people, you are welcome at the table. God is not looking for us to be heroic. God is not looking for us to be perfect. But God is looking for us to reach out. And God is looking for us to be loving. If you want to know who's coming to dinner today, the answer is you, and you, and you, and you, and me. We are all the ones who are coming to dinner. God has set a place at the table for each and every one of us. The spring before I went off to divinity school, we had a campaign kickoff. This is a big deal. And you know, at that point, I was getting one of the fundraising departments, a different one than the one I used to run. And so because of my position, I was assigned a seat at one of the really good tables, back to the table next to the dean. It was a very nice gesture on the part of the person who arranged that dinner to put me there. And I was flattered. And I knew the people. I'd worked with these prospects. It would have been nice to share the meal with them and talk. But I knew I was leaving. I knew I was going to divinity school. And so I went up to one of the junior fundraising officers. And I asked him if he would like to sit at that table in the middle of the action with all the big wheels. And he was stunned. And he was delighted. And he was excited. And he accepted. And he went over. And he sat at that table. And I could see him having conversations with these top prospects. And I went and sat at a table in the back. And I had a lot of fun back there. It was all relaxed. You do the right thing, sometimes something good happens to you. I remember that night, and I don't always remember this, but I remember that night that it wasn't all about me. That it wasn't my dinner. That it was somebody else's dinner, and that it was being put on for a purpose. And I was able to do something to advance that purpose. We here in the church are invited by Jesus to remember that the dinner is being put on all the time, that everybody is welcome, but it's not our dinner. We're the guests. The only thing that's required of us is that we invite others to come along too.